It's very timely with all the things that are going on with the Social Security at the moment to just raise some awareness and look in detail at a very important part of modern. So thank you very much for that. I was going to make a few comments, and hopefully some of the next people can also touch on some of these issues if they'd like to. The first thing that I wanted to say was about delegation. And to me, it was quite interesting because Eliot made the point of saying, comparing or contrasting rather validation and the use test. The way that I always look at validation is that validation really goes hand in hand with the use test. And the reason I say this is that the main purpose of validation is really to get comfort that the model that you're using is right. So, no senior management or no board would actually use their model if it hasn't been validated properly. So almost one way of looking at the use test is that it's a part of validation. Because only if the company actually uses the model does it show that they've got comfort in the results that it's producing. Another point about validation that I wanted to make was around backtesting. And this is actually a more general point than rather just with the paper today, but also links to this, is that there's been quite a lot of comment that backtesting, that there's not always enough data to properly do backtesting. I mean, and the obvious way to look at this is if you're looking at a one-year churn of your event, then you need obviously loads of data to see whether your model is actually right if you look at the confidence intervals around that. So the way that I always look at it is this backtesting is one tool used within validation, and in fact, if the backtesting doesn't actually provide enough comfort that the model is indeed correct, then you should be looking at using additional measures or additional tools alongside backtesting. And the final point I want to make is one that was also touched on by Eliot, is around expert judgment. I think this is going to be a very key part. And Eliot mentioned that about documenting it, and I think that there's a lot of expert judgment within ESGs. And even on the market consistent side, there's still expert judgment relating to the, to where market data isn't actually readily available. So typically things like equity option, equity volatility, over a long period of time. A number of things, and also exactly, the details of the models that you use. That's typically down to extra judgment as well. And those are the points that I have.
Thank you very much, Ian. Please don't, by the way, let the fact that the meeting's been recorded put you off contributing. I think you will be given the opportunity to check whether your contribution really reflected what you wanted to say. Now, who would like to make the next contribution?
I'm the Lockwoods. I want to get my thoughts on some of the ESG-related issues that have occurred to me and have a bearing on how well ESG models and how they're used currently meet the internal model requirements for solvency. My first point relates to statistical quality. In my experience, it's easier for an ESG model run for 1,000 or more scenarios for 40 or more years to produce a not insignificant number of extreme scenarios where inflation rates and interest rates run into hundreds of percent. My question would then be whether the assumptions of a stochastic model that utilises those economic scenarios are consistent with the way the business would be managed in those scenarios and with the way policyholders would behave in such a situation. For example, some of the rules stating that bonus rates on real profits business can change by no more than, say, 15% over a 6-month period clearly do not make sense in such a scenario. I now have some comments regarding documentation. I recently set up a spreadsheet within my company aimed at reducing the calculations in an externally provided ESG model. And the extent and nature of the difficulties I had in doing this reveal something about how close the documentation of the methodology supplied by the provider was to what would be required for an internal model and a Solvency II. In general, I found that each individual component of the model was clearly documented, but the documents were often difficult to find as they were located in many different areas of the provider's website, and I had to ask the provider a significant number of questions in order to reproduce the calculations. And it's clear from this that the work required to make the Solvency II documentation standards should not be underestimated. I would also like to make some remarks that are relevant both to validation and to the use test. In my experience, the areas where effective validation methods for ESG models tend to be in place are in terms of reducing the market prices of the underlying assets and of simple options on them, and of ensuring that sufficient scenarios have been run to reduce sampling error to an acceptable level. However, I feel a key area where I feel more validation work needs to be done is in reconciling stochastic with deterministic models. A company is likely to have difficulty meeting the use test if information being supplied on decision makers on the basis of deterministic models is pointing in a different direction from information supplied on the basis of stochastic models, and there is no explanation given for the differences. It could be that the differences are genuinely due to the time value of options embedded in the business. However, my experience suggests that a company is unlikely to be able to demonstrate that these differences are genuinely due to the time value of options. In particular, it is likely that deterministic and stochastic modelling work will be carried out on different systems with little understanding of how the deterministic model differs from the deterministic run of the ESG model. And it's also likely that system constraints will mean that it's impossible to perform a deterministic run of the ESG. For example, if your ESG has a discrete random variable representing how many of a number of portfolio of corporate bonds defaults in each time period, then that random number of defaults would need to be replaced by its expected value in a deterministic calculation in its deterministic run of the ESG model. And that the ESG model might not have the functionality to calculate that expected value. And resolving this issue will therefore require work both from insurance companies and from external ESG providers. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Who would like to make the next contribution?
Thank you. My name is John Jenkins. I'd like to thank Elliot Walton for a well set out and excellent paper. I agree with an awful lot that's in the paper. I agree that an ESG is absolutely essential for running a business with guarantees. The paper does mention replicating portfolios, but I don't think they're anywhere near sufficiently well developed as a technique to be used for most companies, certainly not in the time frames that Solvency II require. On the governance, my particular take on this is that it's still very difficult to get boards to engage on ESGs. I've sat in on an awful lot of board meetings and audit meetings, sometimes as an advisor, sometimes as an auditor, and it's very difficult to get the board members to actually engage on the ESG issues. It's extremely technical, and it tends to be regarded, or the actor says that that's what's recommended, so that's what we're going with. I've seen very few real discussions about the pros and cons of ESGs. And it's not helped by the fact that there are just four, I think, providers in the market of ESG software, two main ones and one very main one. And there isn't a great deal of variety as a result of that. So I think we've got a long way to go in that area. A particular concern that I have in relation to the ESG providers is we have noticed over the last few years they've started, and it's not blaming them in any sense, but they started to have to make some key assumptions themselves. For example, ultra long-term interest rates when there aren't any particular suitable interest rates in the market. So, for example, a 50-year interest rate, which is what you need if you've got a deferred annuity with a long time to go to retirement, and a guaranteed annuity rate, which takes it another 20 years in, or something like that. And those sort of decisions really are the judgments of the board. But we do find companies lapsing almost by default into using the assumptions that the ESG provider has chosen as its default, which is obviously a particular problem. My last comment is probably that I thought it was going to be very controversial, but it does relate back to what Elliot said when he had his VIX graph up there. The market consistent is all very well, but it does imply that if the market goes crazy, your results are going to go crazy. And the experience is that companies don't like their results going crazy. Whether it be EV results or solvency results, companies don't like their results going crazy. They don't like to be shown insolvent because of the market's on finding out maybe that's right, maybe that's not. But it seems to me this should be an issue that should be addressed. And I was pleased that you mentioned that one of the CEOs papers seemed to get this point. Do we have a big chunk of the insurance industry suddenly insolvent because the market's gone a bit crazy with your Volkswagen marginal pricing graph or something like that? So certainly that's something which I think needs to be properly addressed before this is put in place finally for Solvency II. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Okay, who would like to make the next contribution? Well, more hands up at the start.
I hadn't wanted to follow John, but I'll lead him to the bridge, Nick, next. Actually, not wishing to be repetitive, but following on from a couple of the previous speakers, I'd like to, first of all, like to thank Andy for this paper, because it has pulled together a number of things that I've been thinking about over the last 18 months, and Elliot has succeeded in actually putting down print, which is always the most difficult thing. I do think that Chapter 7 on governance is actually really important, because it is going to be one of the biggest challenges. As John just said, boards don't often understand this type of thing. And I've likened it in the past to our friends in the tax departments of companies and particular clients. And my particular bone of contention with tax people often is that the way that the tax guys do their numbers, they do a balance sheet at the beginning of the year, do a balance sheet at the end of the year, and the tax move is different between the two. And you try, and I'm sure a number of you have, try getting your tax guys to explain why the tax numbers move they up where they have in the year. And I think that ESGs can be a bit like that. I've tried to explain why the result that you had at the beginning of the year and how it's at the mid-year and how it's at the end of the year. We've got to actually get back to validating these numbers and explaining why the results have moved the way they have, which ties into the points that Ian were making. And why I think that's particularly important is because of the importance of the profit and loss attribution and understanding whether the model has gone wrong. And it's exceedingly difficult, as you know, to prove sometimes that an ESG is giving an odd answer because the market is a bit odd, or because it has actually got a problem underlying it. And quite often that data on how the result has come out the way it has is not easily explained. And if you are going to go to your team management and explain why the pricing on a particular product hasn't turned out the way that the product guys thought it would, as happened to one of my clients last year, or why the numbers have gone wacky, is it just because, as at last year end, a lot of team management time was involved for those adopting MCEV in trying to make those management decisions about what to do about adjusting to the market and explaining what the implications are of some of those judgments as we've got to go forward. And it is really important for us to work up a way of really giving that information to senior management so they can understand the basis on which they're making their decisions. And I think that the other point I want to make, which follows on something that Elliot has said, which I think is really important. It struck me many years ago when reviewing an economic capital framework for one of my clients, and there was one particular scenario that was the one globally that created all these economic capital requirements. The same scenario around the world was the one that drove everything. and no one, when we were reviewing it, could explain what that scenario was and why it gave rise to so much economic capital being really deprived. So I do think there is an onus on us investigating the scenarios to understand the backtesting, and not only that, but I think it's also going to be important to actually validate the underlying management actions and or policyholder actions that we build into the models. To actually really understand, and play it back to management, would you really take those decisions in those scenarios? Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Okay, I'd like to introduce.
Morgan, also from FSA and the CEOPS Internal Models Expert Group. I'd also like to thank Elliot for an excellent paper, very helpful paper. It's good to see, from my point of view, discussion about Solvency II and also in this particular area. I particularly like the way you spelled out the misconceptions around the market consistent valuation. I think it's really important to understand where things fail and where things work. And that also ties in with some presentations that I'm doing at the Life Convention and the myths, and some myths about Solvency II, some common misunderstandings. I also particularly like the fact that you highlighted the partial internal model paper. I'd recommend to any company that was thinking of applying to use an internal model to read consultation paper 65, as in my view, most internal models will actually end up being partial internal models rather than full ones, and that brings extra requirements for approval. That paper is open for consultation at the moment, and people can make comments until the 11th of December. I'd also like to add onto what you said about the different tests and standards that CEOPS is recommending for internal models, that the whole aim of the advice that we've given to the European Commission is that these internal models are the ones used in firms, as Ian said. The idea is not to have a regulatory capital model, but to have an economic capital model that's used in the firm to calculate their own capital requirements based on their own risk appetite, and that the regulatory capital is just one output from that model. It's not the main output, it's just one output. And if you're using that model for your own decision making, then the tests and standards as described in the CEOPS papers, it's just basic common sense. You would expect things to be validated, documented, to have good quality data. But that seems to me quite obvious. So I think the tests and standards are good practice and what insurers should be doing anyway if they're using economic capital models. In terms of linking the use and documentation, I think that's important. And I think my personal view is it's possible to have a complex model which is explained simply. So that's something that I think the actuarial profession has been doing for a long time. So I don't think it's necessary to have a simple economic scenario generator to fit in with the fact that the board have to understand it. And it's worth remembering as well that CEOPS gave some advice to the European Commission about proportionality about 18 months ago, where we were very clear that proportionality is a two-way street, so that if risks are complex, then we would expect more complex models to quantify those risks. And proportionality is linked not to the size of an insurer, but to the nature, scale, and complexity of the risks in the insurer. So you could have a small insurer that has complex risks, and we would expect them to be modelled in a complex way. I think the points you made about the statistical quality standard and the quality of data are really good. And they also link to some of the models used in the non-life side as well, for example, catastrophe models. And the big issue, as far as I can see, is how insurers using those models can get a view of the external data and the way that things are modelled, and then how they can link the documentation of what's actually being done into their own documentation so that we as supervisors can review it. Not that we want to see all the documentation, I can say that quite heavily, we want to see evidence that you have got good documentation. You asked a question earlier about whether we would be benchmarking against the standard formula when we're assessing internal models. No. I mean, obviously the information is there, we'll have a look at it, but the point of the internal model is that it reflects your own risk profile, and that you're saying that the standard formula doesn't reflect your risk profile. So by, it might be one of the things we look at, but we won't be benchmarking against that. I also like the mention you made of IT in the paper. Solvency 2 is often seen as an actuarial project, but it's a multifunctional project. And IT, in my view, is really, really key and is perhaps overlooked. My personal recommendation to anybody doing a Solvency 2 implementation would be to involve IT people as early as possible. And I know the FSA's own IT people are actually reading through the CEOPS consultation papers to work out what effect it's going to have on the FSA's own IT systems. And then my final point is going back to the tests and standards for internal model approval. One of the reasons why CEOPS published them all in one paper is because you need to look at them all together. And I think that's the point you've made effectively in the paper by talking about use tests and validation together, validation and documentation. You can't look at each test individually. And it's not like doing your O-levels or GCSEs. It's not a case of I might get an A here and a B there and a C here. You don't have to pass them all in order to get your model approved, not just any one of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. Okay, who'd like to make the next comment? You can't all wait to be the last person to speak. I'm sure there are lots of people who would like to, but now's an opportunity to contribute to what's an important discussion of how profession develops in this area.
I'll come up with some questions for the audience. It's nothing else taking to think about how these answer these. But I'm not actually from life insurance, I'm from general insurance, but I'm the chiefest officer, and my duties these days are much more non-executive than executive. So I'm reading this paper with great interest because I have to help my board challenge our internal modelling of general insurance. And I found it very interesting to pick up lessons how it, very ably I thought, explained an ESG. I read it as a non-life person, as an actuary, and found that I could really, really understand the issues, not the technical issues, but the issues I needed to understand to take decisions on the back of it. So I've got two questions which I'd like to throw to the audience to see if anybody's got any answers to these. So I'm looking at my board, how to get them to understand my internal model, which is not a life insurance internal model. But the big debate we're having at the moment is how far do we take them down the technical road? And we've got to recognise a couple of things. They are required to sign off on these models, my internal model, your ESGs and the life company. Now we've devised a program in-house, myself and my risk management team, of what we think we need to turn around train our board on an internal model, and we've come up with probably 30, 40, 50 mini topics that they need to understand. And if for each of these mini topics you assign a half hour's explanation, that's a lot of time for a board. So when I took that first to the CEO, I knew I was going to get pushback, I expected it. And the current front runner is, he said I'm allowed this year, I'm allowed 2 whole days of the board's time to train them on the internal model before they sign it off. So I'd like to throw that question open to you life guys with your ESG. As I understand it, your ESG must reduce on, I don't know, is it 50% of your capital? 75%? A big chunk. So therefore, it's a really big central part to your board signing off on the capital numbers. So I'm curious to know, if anybody's willing to share experiences, how much time do you think you're going to ask your board to give you to let you train them in your economic scenario generators? That'd be my first question. And if that doesn't apply, I'll try a completely different question. I also noticed at the back end of the list, taking a very interesting reference, that investment analysts, they're going to start getting more and more information out on the outputs of the ESGs. Now, without being unkind to investment analysts, and I hope none of you have got relatives on, the first tool is just plain comparative. They've got company A, B, and C,
I won't mention names to do this, but as you know, you can think of the biggest life company in the UK, you can think of the second biggest company in life company in the UK, you can think of its peers in the CRO forum in Europe. And they're bound to ask you, I want to know what your chief inputs to your ESG were, so I can rank your own estimates compared to your peers, and then I can say whether your stock valuations are higher or lower. So I'm really quite interested. Suppose you were put on the spot by an investment analyst. Your company wants to make a big rights issue. He says you need to tell me enough information about your ESG so I can compare it with your competitors. Now, I like your option take approach, Elliot. I'd be interested to know whether that idea is going to fly or not. And to come back to my own industry, so I don't work in life, I work in non-life. My biggest risk is natural catastrophe peril risk. I use a firm called RMS to validate 50% of my capital. And I get this question from investment analysts. They say, tell me, Andrew, what percentage of the RMS figures do you use to value your cap risk? My heart sinks at this question because it's a lot subtler than that. But you can see where they're coming from. They want to know, am I using 100% or am I taking a haircut of 90% or am I loading it? Because actually I do load it. I load it for parameter uncertainty. Now, my loading for parameter uncertainty is completely arbitrary. Around number, it's purely because it's better than zero. So I actually use the standard nat cat model times a loading factor. And I hope that means my earnings are quite conservative, and I want an investment analyst to know that. So that would be my question back to you guys. How would you explain to an investment analyst how he can compare your ESG valuation axes to one of your competitors? So those are questions and answers, Mr. Chairman, but hopefully they might provoke some more debate.
Thank you, Andrew. Now, does anybody brave enough in the audience wish to rise to one or two of those challenges? Catherine, I mean,
obviously, I can't rise to your challenges, I'm sure, although I've noted down everything you said.
More questions.
Just to expand on your first question, it's probably worth spelling out the responsibilities of the board in respect of internal models. So, people who've read the governance papers that have come out of CEOPS will see that the general principle there is kind of a joint understanding, a joint responsibility for governance. But for internal models, CEOPS advice is slightly different, and what we're looking for there is an individual understanding. So each board member needs to understand individually the internal model to some extent. And then if they're actually using it in decision making, say they're executive directors, then they need to understand it in the areas where they're using the model. So that's perhaps just a little bit of extra sort of colour to your question, Andrew.
Thank you for that additional reminder, Catherine. Okay, does anybody with that extra qualification like to rise to the challenge that Andrew has laid down? No, we had some silence. There must be someone up there. Prepare to bring it up.
Of the two questions, I think the second one, and the analysts, is not that difficult to answer on ESGs. We already have a table in the FSA returns where you have to work out what answer your ESG produces for certain standard derivatives, like a 20-year put, 5-year put option, and something else and something else. And you can work out with your ESG what that comes out as, and you can benchmark that across different companies and compare the ESG. So I think that one is sort of not as difficult as it sounds. I'm feeling quite slow to be able to answer your question. I think the board time one, first of all, I readily recognise what you said about the 2 days training. In our practice, we do board training for various things. And including Solvency II, and actually getting that amount of time allocated to the board on any subject, including internal models, is actually quite a challenge, and companies don't go around dispensing 2 days of board time here and there for really, so to speak. So something like up to a week is what I would sort of think would be the maximum for most boards. If we're expecting to get them all together in a room, we give them a training session on soil testing and something else. And coming back to Catherine's point, I think this is actually quite difficult because you can write down on one side of A4 that you can point to sort of the key aspects of the internal model, and you can say, well, all the board understand that. It's a question of how many layers of the onion you peel off and how much detail do they need to understand. You can just do it very, very high level, or you could go right down to more detailed granular level. And my concern is that the board members will tend to switch off at a fairly early stage and won't be willing to spend the amount of time that it might take according to what the FSA is thinking. So I do think we have a mismatch from what the regulator is saying and what most board members think they might have to spend by way of time.
Thank you, John. Does anybody else want to rise to Andrew's challenge or make a different comment? I'm sure there are a few hands that will wave that haven't yet spoken. My name is Ralph Franklin. Perhaps in the interest of transparency, I ought to admit that Alice and I have been working on a working party for a couple of years now, the Extreme Events Working Party. Some of our results have been published, and there's a few more due out to my convention later this week. Congratulations, Alice, on a wonderful paper, which I think actually does rather the opposite of what we did on the Extreme Events Working Party, in the sense that there we were taking data and essentially analysing it to come up with estimates of risk levels and corresponding movements in market indicators. Here, it's more about synthesising those sorts of extreme events to generate a model which is capable of estimating capital that's needed for either Solvency II or indeed any VAR-based environment or insurance. I have a question which, in one sense, is not really about the paper at all, but Elliot does spend some time explaining the importance of the use test within Solvency II, and indeed I believe there was a similar principle applied in the ICA environment that was intended that internal models should be those which are used in relation to the business. And this gives me a degree of concern as a concept. I'm assuming that internal models can be quite variable in nature, the extent to which they apportion different risks to different events. We're working at levels of probability which are very, very low, so it's not surprising that one model may give a higher risk of one event happening, another model might have higher risks for other events happening. But I wanted to compare two fairly simple models, or two simple facets of two models. These two hypothetical models differ only in one respect. That is, that for the two risks, which I've labelled 1 and 2, model A ascribes a 1 in 150th, a 1 in 150 year probability. In model 2, it ascribes a 1 in 250 year probability. The other model, conveniently, has the two risks the other way around. So it will ascribe to event 1 a 1 in 250 year probability, and to event 2 a 1 in 150 year event probability. As I see it, and I may be mistaken here about the proposed application of the use test, if I'm correct, then the company that's chosen to use model A will not unnaturally be more concerned at the event that has the 1 in 150 year probability, that's to say event 1, and will take action either through reinsurance or through changing its asset strategy or through other methods of managing the business to try and reduce that risk, or possibly to eliminate it entirely. The company that's chosen to use Model B will instead focus on the second of the two risks, which it sees as having a higher probability, assuming that it's using its ESG and its internal model for its company management. Now, there's nothing actually wrong with that approach. It works fairly well, and I think different companies should rightly focus on the risks to which they're most concerned. The thing that causes me some concern is if you then use the same model, and that's the point about the use sets, it does encourage you to use the same model to determine your capital requirements, you'll tend to look more heavily at those risks which you have tended to eliminate, and therefore to underprice the aggregate risk in the organisation. Now, my question, it's really aimed at delegates who spent a lot more time looking at this than I have. Is this a risk with the Solvency II regime and the requirement to adopt the use test or to support the use of the internal model through a use test? Or have I missed something somewhere in the analysis? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. George will manage to send it up to the end. Should say this. In a week in which we've seen in the Northwest a 1 in 1,000 year amount of rainfall, which does seem to happen more frequently than the forecasters suggest, I do wonder whether this whole area of trying to quantify what is an extreme event is one in which we should tread extremely carefully if we're not going to not only get ourselves into a bit of a mess ourselves, but also in terms of how we are perceived by the outside world and the coherence of the models that we create if they don't seem to stand up to some common sense reasoning. But I'll let you have a few more minutes to consider an answer, unless you really want to.
Off the top of my head, I think we should probably let Catherine and Ian talk about what their intentions are in the use of particularly, but my point would be that it's actually dangerous just to stick with one model. So the issue that you tend to have from the ESG perspective, if you rely on one particular model year in, year out, it's going to do what you say, it's going to ascribe certain probabilities to you, then people take the calibration as it changes from quarter to quarter. So one of the things that's important to do, from my perspective, is to have different models and try to apply that. So in an ideal world, if I was sitting in an insurance company and I wanted to have an ESG model, what I want is to have my economic function part of my basis and say this is where I'd like it to calibrate to, and then I'd have 10 maybe different combinations of models which will be calibrated against that economic basis, and then I'd try out to test my result on against each one of those different combinations of 10 models, and where I see differences in the result that comes out from each one of those 10 different model configurations, that would be, I think, quite educative about telling me where the holes were in the model that I use normally. And then I think when I think about an internal model, I don't just think about one particular model like that. I think you can expand the definition of an internal model, as I understand it. But if you expand it to actually include several models. So an internal model could be that you run your economic capital under several different model configurations, and then you take some average of those, or there is some element of expert judgment to dive in and examine what results you get out of that. But we should probably ask Catherine and Ian if that would pass their tests.
Yeah, Catherine, do you want to comment?
Yeah, thanks. Okay, well, there are quite a few questions to actually answer, so I'll try and go through them. I think the first thing to just say, and that's something which Catherine said earlier as well, is that I mean, what are we actually talking about when we're talking about an internal model? Are we talking about the internal model that's looking at the actual regulatory capital? Or are we actually looking at the internal model which is used in the business? So, as Kat had said, the way at least that we at Dex and in CRPC see this is that it's the internal model which is used for the business. And out of that, so you can have your own risk appetite, and as the calibration standard says, that doesn't have to be a bar measure. There could be a different measure, it could be a different risk measure, that you actually look at. But of course, what you have to do is you have to calibrate it back to that SCR level of the 1 in 200 of the basic owned funds. Right, okay, so the other thing that I wanted to say, which actually comes up in the statistical quality standards, is that the internal model, it actually, if you look at the way that it's described in both the directive and also in the further, in the advice given by CIRPs, it's a probability distribution function. So to ask the question of where you've got your risks that are falling below your 1 in 200 and just above your 1 in 200, what we're actually quite keen on promoting within CIRPs and the SA is to actually look at the whole distribution to actually help you generate your decisions. Because, yes, if you look at how the board makes decisions, it's not going to be making decisions just on a 1 in 200 basis. It wants to know a bit more about what would happen at different probability intervals as well. So I hope, Rob, that answers your question to some extent. You know, that it's not only that once it falls over the 1 in 200 level that it actually needs to be, that the board needs to look at it. It's actually the whole distribution and what drives your, because I mean, the boards are going to be interested in, how's your profit going to vary from year to year? What's the sort of the 1 in 10 bad event that could happen? You know, and by actually having the whole probability distribution function, you could have that. And I know that this is, especially for life firms, it's a bit of a challenge in terms of actually getting the whole probability distribution function, because I think a lot of the ICA sort of techniques and models that have been used show for market risks using ESGs, you could actually have the whole distribution, or at least 1,000 points on the distribution. Whereas for the other sort of underwriting risks, they were mainly looking at specific points. So I think this is one of the key challenges for the life industry, and the CIRPs advice does have quite a bit of information in there about using key points on the distribution and how you could look at further validation and documentation of it. The other point, which Elliot raised, of course, is the aspect of having different models. Now, I think it's very clear in the advice that there's one modeling framework. So if you have a different, if you have different sort of calculation kernels and different bits and pieces of that model, that's fine. As long as you've defined your model and you've got your model in such a way where you don't just all of a sudden start picking and choosing and using different bits for this and that. I mean, it all needs to be well defined, but I mean, it's all good and well to have a lot of pieces in it, as long as you define what it is that you do have. And I think also, to some extent, some of the explanation given by Elliot as well about having all these different checks and techniques of different sort of calibrations and so on, I think that all actually forms part of validation as well, because it's a way in which you gain comfort over the results that are actually coming out of the model. So I hope that answers one of the questions.
Thank you. Now we've got time for one or two contributions. So if you were saving up to be the last person to have the last word, now is your opportunity. Okay, well, in which which case, I will hand over to Chris Chappell to close the discussion for us.
Thank you. First, Elliot, thank you for the paper. And probably the first I've received from you without a formula in sight. I hope my closing captures some of the thoughts of what I presume to be a collective of keen practitioners of stochastic calculus, to which you refer in your introduction. Given the advantages we have had in the UK with the ICA regime, it does make me wonder how easily other countries will find it to make the significant transition that the Solvency II framework requires, and in particular some sympathy with the regulators, as there are difficulties this creates trying to maintain that level playing field. The requirements of the tests for internal models, model approval remains somewhat nebulous, and although I believe companies are working with best endeavours to achieve what they believe will be compliance, Section 3 of your paper draws out some of the difficulties in getting to the likes of a calibration standard, or maybe areas where expert judgment will remain crucial as objective bases remain elusive. The consultation papers from SEOPS seem to be articulating the ideal standard, which may not be wholly achievable, for example, permanently deepened liquid markets. And additionally, you talk about market consistency in real-world scenarios, and it would be interesting for your views on whether the market-consistent approach is inherently pro-cyclical, and whether market-consistent valuation could be modified in light of recent financial crises. I suppose that leads to further questions as to whether our current ESGs are good enough, or whether further improvement is needed. And with that in mind, the comments about disclosure. How should ESG scenarios best be disclosed? The FSA tables to date, are they sufficient? Section 4 details alternative approaches that may be useful for valuing liabilities. Whilst the more simplified modelling approaches, such as closed form solutions, may have limitations, they may be necessary for projecting balance sheets to achieve reasonable and timely management information. It is evident that this will add increased pressure on our communication skills, and I do start to feel sorry for the non-executives of 2012, bombarded with explanations of shortcomings of closed form solutions, such that we choose an ESG to value our balance sheet day one. We then explain to them we project balance sheets using closed form solutions, which are sufficiently robust. I think John Jenkins also adds to the mix by saying ESG providers are starting to make key assumptions, such as those for long-term interest rates. And some of these assumptions are those that should be set by the board, and inadvertently the boards are defaulting to assumptions from ESG providers. I'd be interested in your views for the implications for members of the board, and maybe the dangers of getting a lot of techies and the disappearance of some elements of common sense. I appreciate the list of documentation that you've provided and that you think will be necessary. Interestingly, providers may be preparing a significant element of these. However, even though providers may supply documents, it may not be to a quality appropriate for users, and extra documentation requirements may still remain for companies. And as said, we shouldn't underestimate what this will bring. Additionally, I'd be interested in your views on the change control process for ESGs. We don't want to stifle technical enhancements, but do need to ensure control and stability. But we need to recognise that sometimes it's in the moments of commercial pressure then enhancements are most easily justified for development expenditure when we're competing for resources.
Thank you, Chris. Right, our final official part of the evening, I'll ask Elliot to respond to Chris's and your comments this evening.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you very much for all the kind comments on the paper. That's much appreciated. So I've made some notes, and hopefully I can cover off most of the comments that were made. Just looking down here, Ian spoke first, and I don't think Ian said anything there which I would disagree with at all. Oliver spoke about, particularly about deterministic scenarios and matching those up against stochastic scenarios and how that works. I suppose my take on that is that in the past, people have taken decisions and used tests. De facto use tests at the moment have been done using deterministic scenarios. I can't help thinking that's just got to change, though. If we're moving into a world where we need an internal model, a probability distribution for the SCR, and then that needs to be signed off as being something that the business uses to make decisions, then that really necessitates the fact that senior management need to start using stochastic models in order to make decisions in their businesses. And so my view is that that needs to be an education process that management needs to go through, and we're going to be a key part in helping them through that. John Jenkins talked about the governance issues, particularly around the difficulty in getting engagement with boards of directors, the fact that it might send them to sleep if you try talking to them about too much through the SDs. I actually had an experience doing this a few years ago where another thing that crops up when you're trying to talk to non-executives is you get hooked on a particular technical issue and you spend 45 minutes on it and they don't get off. Particularly, what happened to me is we got stuck on the pseudo-random number seed variables, and we ended up with half an hour spent wasted on who chose the seed value, which turned out to be a student in one of our offices. And I couldn't really get him off the subject of it, but so don't you raise seed values if you're talking to non-executive directors. But where I see this trigonometrics real, I mean, I think the mathematics is something you need to keep well away from boards of directors, unless you've got someone who's particularly keen, who's got that sort of background. In some sense, this is where I feel the economist function really comes into its own. One thing that I would hope that non-exec directors and boards are able to get their head around is some of the key economic assumptions that we're making. So what do we expect equity markets to return over the next few years? How uncertain do we think equity markets are going to be? Where do we expect interest rates to go? And that feels like it can be made into something that is quite a real discussion about what's happening in the wider economy, what's happening in the news, what, for example, the Bank of England are doing. And I would hope that the non-executive directors of a financial institution have enough interest in what's happening in the wider financial markets and in the economy to have views about what the economic basis looks like going forward. So then Nick stood up and talked a bit about governance again. I guess we can talk a bit about there about my response to what Nick says is really around disclosure, trying to help people to understand what is inside the box. I actually found, and what I noticed down from when Nick was talking, is that what I thought would really address this well is the option table. I think Andrew maybe attributed the FSA's option table to me. I can't claim any responsibility for that at all, much as I would have liked to. This is an option table that was put in place for the realistic balance sheet. I found that as an ESG practitioner extremely useful, and I would be disappointed if that were to disappear in Solvency II. I think it's, strictly with some modification, and there are other things that you could add, but that seems to me an extremely valuable way of being able to allow people to benchmark different ESGs and see what's changed. The point that Nick was making was around how you do a sort of analysis of movement on the ESG, how you see how things have moved from the end of one year to the end of the next year. And having tried to calibrate ESGs myself, I can clearly, being on the sharp end of actually having to do it, it's frustrating when you're trying to recalibrate them, when you make them move to hit one particular variable and another variable pops out over here, not quite what you wanted. But an option table is a relatively nice, relatively concise, clear way of articulating what's changed in the model. And I think some of the things that are missing from the current episode table, which I would like to see in Solvency II, are correlations and dependencies particularly. You can reverse engineer some correlations out of the FSA's current option table, but there's a lot more that you could have in there. And I think that would be very helpful for Solvency II. Catherine made a lot of very good points and talked about how to interpret the advice that SIOPS has produced. And I was very pleased to hear her say that insurers wouldn't be benchmarked against the stochastic equity stress test. I would like to ask her if she's 100% sure on that, because I do wonder if one has a dynamic equity stress test, and if you think about the reverse engineering of that stress test against, which is in current paper 69, 9 months after the crash in 2008, that stress test has reverted back up to minus 55%. Now, that means that everyone on the standard form is going to be on minus 55%, is going to be having the most onerous equity stress test they could do. It's quite unreasonable, I would say, that if a company had designed their own dynamic equity stress test, they might still feel quite reasonable in sitting on minus 35%.